Lee, thanks for joining me remotely. Where are you today?
Super happy to chat, John. I'm in New York at the moment, enjoying the sun, the springs here.
Awesome, awesome. Well, look, I appreciate the chance to speak to you for sure. I always enjoy our conversations. Obviously, you're with Blenheim Shalcott. Can you tell the listeners what Blenheim Shalcott is, what you guys do?
Yeah, so Blenheim Shalcott is headquartered in London, but also operating in the US now for a few years. And it's a venture builder. So Blenheim Shalcott creates ventures from scratch and then invests in them, scales them, and helps them grow. And so it's a slightly different approach to venture capital in that it stays operationally in control for the business pretty much through its life until it's very mature, and then supports its businesses with shared resources, typically giving them kind of an information, learning, and cost advantage they wouldn't get if they were trying to build something on their own.
It's really awesome. I was introduced to you guys probably 4 or 5 years ago, and it's really, really amazing
Yeah, and we wanted
what
to
they've
hire
built.
you, didn't we? We kept trying to find, but
We
then you went
will
off and
find
did it
something.
yourself.
We'll find something to collaborate on. I'm sure it's but it is one of the most fascinating companies that I've encountered, and very, very successful, obviously. How many, when you say shared resources, how many employees are there across the portfolio at this point? Do you know that off the top of
So,
your head?
yeah. So the shared resources are really based on what do the companies need again and again that would give them an advantage. And so we have low cost functional resources based in India, which are actually growing to more technical expertise. We've got 150 people out in Mumbai, led by a great BC manager, Girish, who basically provides all kinds of accounting services, marketing, technical deployment, customer success, RPA now, tech dev. And so you go into that office and there's, nine of our businesses up and running with different people supporting them there. So it's amazing to see. And then in the UK and here, it's about circa another 40 odd people who are domain expertise. So expertise in tax, which comes up a lot, right? And investments team who run our fundraising, go-to-market marketing, training, hiring, all the areas that, shared expertise really helps and gives a business an advantage.
And what is your role at Blenheim?
Yeah, so I joined Blenheim. I've been in New York for 10 years, and I joined Blenheim almost 3 years ago exactly, to help more of the companies come into the US and scale here and grow. So my role can be, John, from getting the coffee in to hosting a meeting to taking on an operational management role to fill a gap to helping with hiring, helping with investment, helping with some strategy. It's fireman, Sherpa, and anything in between. Because you know what it's like with startups, everyone's got 10 hats on and you're moving. And then in supporting our businesses as they come in, it's about, filling in all the gaps as they scale and gear up.
That's awesome. So how many portfolio companies are there right now?
So we've got 20 companies at Blenheim Shalcott, and those companies, we've got a great expertise in fintech. We've got a great expertise in education and edtech. We've also got a music AI business, which is very unique, and Tencent recently invested in it with us. We've got a great sports team, a cricket team in India, the Rajasthan Royals, for anybody listening, which is super impressive.
It's very
That
impressive.
business.
I, as an ignorant American, I wasn't aware of just how big the sport is. And
It's
I don't know if
massive.
you told me or Manoj told me, somebody pointed out on any given television appearance, they have more viewers than the Super Bowl, right?
It's just absolutely enormous as a sport. It's, close to religion, cricket in India. A number of other areas, some media companies. B2B is our strong flavor across everything, but there are like the cricket team, et cetera, some and the music AIs and B2C businesses too.
How many of those you have? So you have 20 across the portfolio, and I believe that there are more in EMEA than in America. How many of those have jumped the pond?
So in the US, we've got our fintechs, because London took a lead on fintechs because of open banking. That regulation change meant a lot of technology companies plugged into the more openness of banking to give better services to banking customers. And so they stole a march from the US. A lot of fintechs have come to the US, taking that advantage of 2 or 3 years and bringing it here. So we have Salary Finance, which is an employee benefit lending business. We have Liberis, which lends to small business using technology. We have Researcher, which sells with a sales agent here. It's a media business for scientists. We have Contentive, a B2B business. And then Hive Learning, another business on the ground here, does diversity and inclusion training at scale. It's a digital focused business. So five of them kind of really plugging away and growing and doing really well here.
Do you ever see a day when there are any America that start in America and go back to Europe or?
I think we definitely like some ideas that we see here where we would then create those businesses in the UK. But if we think about our advantage, it's our B2B network and our expertise at creating businesses with a ton of resources around them. We own a property business called ScaleSpace, which incubates and puts our companies all in together alongside a business school from Imperial College and corporates. So in terms of a place to create a business, that's the place.
Sure.
Where we can give it a lot of love and support. So I can see it's taking ideas from the US and taking them to the UK and then moving on really quickly. So an example you might look at is Credit Karma here. It's a great big business, right? And we've got ClearScore in the UK, which is a very similar business and doing
very
great.
Interesting. Are you guys were part of Credit Karma, or you're just saying that they're comparable?
No, it's just
businesses?
Very similar to ClearScore.
I've heard of ClearScore. I thought I read a press release about that a few years ago.
So ClearScore is a massive business. It's the market leader ahead of Experian and everyone else in the UK in terms of being a credit generation business, lead gen business for others. And it's growing in Australia and other markets.
Excellent. So you mentioned that you've been with Blenheim for 3 years. What were you doing prior to this?
Yeah, so prior to that, I was CEO of a business called the New York Institute of Finance, where my job was to do a turnaround. And it was this beautiful old brand that was 90 years old, serving capital markets and training them in everything from M&A to fixed income. It just got out of love with its main owner, which was Pearson at the time, who hadn't really invested in it. And FT was also owned by Pearson. So at FT, I took on turning that around, and we turned that business into a digital revenue generating business where previously it was only classrooms. We grew out in China, which was a big market, and just scaling up e-learning. And then we eventually sold it to Chinese private equity in 2017, which was my job. My job was to turn it around and sell it.
That's awesome. How did you get introduced to Blenheim then?
Yeah, so Blenheim looked at that business. So we do like IP and brands that maybe are distressed and not looked after. And we see a new opportunity because some change is happening in the market. Like education, the big change was MOOCs and e-learning. So that's why we, Blenheim Charcot, and I got to know them through that, through mutual contacts at the FT.
Very cool. In your experience, what do you see as a big difference between the successful portfolio companies and less successful ones? Is it luck, or is there something else?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, because I think there's a huge amount of luck. But you can get luckier by doing some of the right things, right? You can move the probabilities in your favor, because most startups fail is absolutely true. I think what I've seen that works really well is not over-investing early, but concentrating on finding a problem that's big enough with a lot of customers where your solution is really just better, whether that's faster, cheaper, easier experience, and iterating on that. And just, I think that's the thing that I've seen early on that the better companies are doing. They know they're probably wrong a lot. They're doing a scientific method of just trying to find what works, and you get a few failed starts and the market's just not big enough. And then what happens is they become less vague. So the better businesses are very specific about who their customer is exactly, the job they're trying to do, how they're solving the problem and the value. And then also, kind of the specificity of that. You can just see it in everything they do, in the language they use. And then the execution, they execute really, really well. You know, and like the lifeblood of execution, John, is comms, communication. Like the decision-making in the company lives on it, right? What's the data charts and all hands meeting, leadership behaviors? What's the framework for deciding? Like they've got that nailed. The comms is really, really good. The leadership comms is good, so they can execute. And then the other thing is, like, is the timing right? Like, is this market really kicking? The example is Hive Learning. Diversity inclusion pre George Floyd was a nice to have. It was important in the US. They hired D&I managers, but they didn't give them a budget. They went around telling people that inclusion was important. And then George Floyd, every company realized this racism is systemic. We better do something about it and do our fair share. And they all got given a budget. And Hive got lucky because it was on the pitch. It'd been building D&I for 2 years, testing, investigating, speaking to those people, and they all suddenly started buying.
Well, and
the solution was perfect.
And COVID pushed things to remote, which plays very strongly to Hive, correct?
Yeah. And Jim Collins writes about that in B2.A. He writes about these look events, like some massive changes, and never waste a crisis is the other language people use. And it's so true. It's like, what's the lemonade from these lemons? Mm-hmm. And that we thought a lot like that during COVID, all of our companies, what's the lemonade? And then get after it.
Very cool. So you talked about the difference between successful portfolio companies and less successful. You've had some companies that have pivoted a couple of times and maybe weren't as successful early on, but then became successful, and it's the same team, right?
I think if you're on the right pitch, right, you think a market in an area, for example, instrumental, it's in the market of helping independent artists, and actually record labels and others are being disaggregated by the web. Artists can own their own music and publish and make money on their own. So it's in the right space. And where it started was selling SaaS AI to labels. And that ended up being a smaller market, but the independents we were trying to serve as well grew bigger. So it pivoted and just focused totally on those independents. And it's actually almost like a funding business. It funds small artists so they can concentrate on the music and publish in return for some digital rights, but lets the artists retain control, you know, of their future. And it's going really well. But it was on the right pitch. You can't win unless you at least are willing to kind of test and do some failures. That's more important, I think, than kind of trying to think you can get it right. You've got to know you're going to be wrong a few times.
You're speaking my language. I recently released a rant where I ranted about getting in the game. I was like, don't worry about being perfect. Just get it started and then figure it out. And I think it's so true.
Yeah, I think worry about, is it the right game to get in? Mm-hmm. Is this a space you like? What are all the macro trends that say it's going to be a growing space? And then just bundle yourself in and have a look around and try some things. Yeah. And you know, good people will work out what the right solution problem is to plug into.
Yeah. Well, and along those lines, you see a lot of entrepreneurs in your role, obviously. You were one yourself. Yeah. Do you see things that entrepreneurs regularly get wrong, or do you have advice that you find yourself giving over and over again beyond get on the pitch?
That is a fantastic question. What's the right answer to that? Wow, that's such a good question. You stumped me. I think.
I'll tell you one that's right along with what you were talking about earlier. I think that the communication, oftentimes entrepreneurs get wrong. They tend to be overly optimistic. And so the investor letters that I see, it's always everything's perfect. And I don't think that that's useful. I think bad news is the most useful information. Good news is okay, I expect it. But when all I hear is good news, I think a lot of people do that. And you need to be optimistic to do this, because it's a very difficult life at times. But
I think that is great advice that you give people. You know, the thing you need to be is optimistic and trusted and realist in what's going right and wrong. And your investors and partners are much more likely to stay with you when you share, this is not what's not working. I'm still trying to work out this is what is, this is where we're going to test some things. That's much, you know, more trustable and backable than, hey, everything's going great, blah, blah, blah. Because it's never, ever going great.
No.
It's never, ever everything going great. So I think that's great.
I've had to force myself in investor communications. And what I do is I put a template together that is the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there has to be, there has to be one of each at least, right? And that forces me to tamper the optimism.
Yeah, because investors are smart. They've seen things before. They can help you with what's not going well, and they know things pivot. And you're much, you know, you're backing a team in the right market. You're not really attached to the solution or problem in terms of, is it the right one? And if we need to change that, great. But you've bought in on based on a market normally, then you think that specific thing should be the winner.
So I have to talk about this. You were a professional boxer at one point, right?
No, I was only ever an amateur. My father was a professional. He was British champion. He was a great fighter. Wow. And I was just okay. I think to be a really great boxer, you need a lot more like tenacity and bad intentions, I think Mike Tyson calls them, than I had. I think I was too nice, but I love boxing. I boxed for many years.
Okay. Most of the Blenheim folks that I've met are athletic or have been involved in sports. You mentioned owning a cricket team. I think Hive Learning was created by or run by the famous coach of the National Rugby Championship team, right? Is this something that Blenheim actively seeks out, or is it just a coincidence? Because I know a lot of companies like to have people who have played on team sports because they make better teammates sometimes. But
yeah, I think Blenheim's philosophy is long-term patient thinking on startups, and you know, we know it's going to take years, where the media would have you think you can spin up a startup and it's worth billions and it's sexy, and it isn't like that in the real world. So that long-term thinking really fits sports athletes and disciplined people. Musicians is the other one. There's a lot of musicians because they're willing to do the cold long hours when no one's watching, working on something repetitively, so that when it's time to perform and execute, you've just got that muscle memory and discipline. And I think that's what you see at Blenheim Schalke, and why I could see why a lot of sports people are around, because they're attracted to that longer term thinking and getting ready for it and putting in the hours of discipline that others won't. And that's like a start world. You know, if you outwork other people and you'll keep going when they give up, you're going to bump into some success in the end. But yeah, musicians, people who've got that discipline to continue, I think, is probably what you're seeing.
I saw Sir Clive speak in New York. You were kind enough to invite me to an event. And he talked about everything that went into putting that great rugby team together. And just it was so much more than what he put into that team and what they did. There's a reason that they won, but it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily what everybody thought. He showed given laptops, which at the time wasn't necessarily standard practice, and investments in software, and just studying every detail to the point where he changed the rugby shirts to fit more tightly so that people couldn't tackle as easily. But it was really fascinating to hear everything that goes into putting that type of a team together. I believe they were the only rugby team to date that has been from the Northern Hemisphere to win the World Cup, right?
Yeah, he's right. It was fascinating how he did it, and to be so meta on himself and the team, where he let good ideas come from anywhere. They would try things and constantly observe what they're doing and see what's working, what's not working. And kind of the best companies do that as well, don't they? They're always tinkering and trying to improve and get it better and, you know, being reflective. I think it's a great metaphor for that.
Absolutely. And you have to create a culture where people can speak out and question things. Yeah. And that's not necessarily easy to do for some organizations.
Right. Yeah, because also a lot of the best people are quiet or introverts, and it's enabling them to flourish and come forward because they're deeper thinkers or they're detailed thinkers. But you'll have people like me who are like a bit loud or whatever and more confident in a room. And it's like, how do you make sure that everybody gets heard and speaks up, because they're the ones who actually can probably solve the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. So has your boxing helped you out in your business career?
Yes, I can take a lot of punches, John. Yeah, I think like when I did my startup, it was an outdoor advertising business, and I made probably every error you could make because I'd got a certain level of competence. I was 30 and successful in advertising. and I just didn't want to let anything stop me. And actually, if I'd have looked at the market more closely, I'd have seen it was oversupplied and it was very controlled, the whole Porter's Five Forces. But I just kept going, like my will to succeed, and I found a way to do it. And that just comes from not being prepared to lose. But what I did learn the hard way is you should be prepared to lose sometimes. Like you should look and maybe pivot and go in a different direction.
That's the hardest thing.
I think it's helped me. Yeah,
it's hard. To me, that's the hardest thing is like, you know, at some point there are things that you have to just cut bait on, but
yeah,
you also know
what's your decision making around that, John? How do you think about that then?
I don't know that I feel like I just know at some point, right? So, so one of my failures was a company called Reward Summit, where I built a mobile app for picking the best credit card. And the first two versions of the app were terrible. And then we built a very, very good version that Apple actually featured in the App Store. And then Lifehacker blogged about it. And then the downloads exploded. And So we felt very good about it. And I mean, we had tens of thousands of users and people using the app, and you could see that people are using it. We never really figured the business model out though, because we weren't able to build the relationships with the banks to actually sell the credit cards, because that was the business model. And they were, the affiliate model was just really changing. And that was a hard one to walk away from, because we had had all of the success and it was very visible and we have the downloads. But we had also started Level at that point, and it was starting to take off. And at some point we just looked at it and we said, well, we've got a business that's making $10 million a year here. And we've got this other one that isn't doing anything. And it was painful to shut it down. But I think in that case, in many ways, I don't know that we would have made the same decision without Level there. So I think there's so many factors. And at some point I just have an intuition that says, you know what, I've got to go this direction.
Yeah, it's context specific, isn't it? The thing is, you just have to be thoughtful when it happens and know why you're making the decision. I think it's always context specific. Yeah. It's so interesting what you said. You're either looking for demand, but once you've found it, you're trying to find a way to execute. So you've either got finding a demand problem, or how do I execute this problem?
That was the frustrating part. We were so from a user experience perspective, we would show you a card that you could be using at a store and getting better rewards with it. And then we had apply for this card. So we could tell you what your card, the best card you have, but here's the card that you don't have. Well, we were only able to sell three or four different credit cards, and they weren't the best credit cards.
Yeah.
What we would do from a user experience perspective is if you clicked on, I want to apply for this card, we would still send you over to an affiliate site, but we wouldn't get paid commission on it. So we could see that we're generating leads, but the banks just could not wrap their head around a mobile acquisition. They every time we would talk to an affiliate manager, they would say, well, how many hits do you have on your website? And we're like, no, it's not a website. It's a mobile app. It's like, it's part of the experience is applying for credit cards. And when you show them the numbers, tens of thousands of users is just not enough users. They're used to selling through a completely different channel. And that it was so frustrating, because you could tell, like, oh, this people want to actually do what we're asking them to do, but the model just wasn't there.
Yeah, annoying. Yeah. Massively annoying.
Yeah. So you guys have a lot of momentum in the portfolio that you've already talked about. Are there one or two that are kind of that have everybody's attention in Blenheim, or is it just momentum kind of across the board?
Yeah, I think our business modular, which is making business payments a lot easier, and you know modular well, John.
Yep.
That business is kind of massively living up to its potential. It's not in the US yet. It recently had VC rounds come in from PayPal and FIS.
Who are
interested in scaling its technology, because anything to do with B2B payments, old school payments, is a pain. Anybody who has to get an invoice paid or anything and reconcile or knows what I mean by that. And then, you know, it can embed banking as a service and account set up, virtual accounts anywhere. Revolut, you know, very famous fintech, powers its accounts with modular's technology. So it's getting embedded in a lot of other fintechs who are leveraging what it does. So that's a really exciting business for us.
And that's a great example where Miles, who runs it, had already run a business for Blenheim before and successfully ran another business, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that seems to be the case at Lenom, because they care a lot about networks and people. You know, it tends to be a crew who just keep building and working together, and that just compounds the success. So there's a lot of ex-Capital One, a lot of modular consultants, a lot of great people who are working together regularly and building new businesses.
And modular, I love payments. Our biggest success story in Charlotte is Avid Exchange, which plays in the B2B payment space. But with modular in particular, I love this business, not just because it's payments, but you aren't really building the customer experience. You just make it painfully easy for other developers to do that. Yeah. So it really doesn't matter what the customer experience is, that your plumbing is being used. And in this case, there's not just integration into payment systems, which is not an easy thing to do. There's all sorts of sticky bits around compliance and governance and KYC, and you're simplifying all of that for them. Are there other businesses in the portfolio that take this API-driven approach, or do you normally own the customer experience too?
Yeah, so that kind of embedded finance, which is blowing up, right, as a category, I think Bain Capital shouted it out that, you know, the businesses and economy it's going to create there can be bigger than the internet, I think. Was a great blog. We have Liberis, which is lending as a platform. So Liberis goes to market and gets small businesses financed really fast, because a lot of small businesses can't get access to capital from banks. Typically 80% get turned down. They just operate at a different credit level. And Liberis funds those businesses through partners like Worldpay or Global Payments, Elavon and others. And gets that business there fast through API. So we're part of Worldpay's dashboard, the merchant sees, the Worldpay marketing goes out, et cetera. And so that platform business is also adding other lending products to it. So you can open accounts. So you've suddenly got a cash flow account. You can pull forward your revenues as a small business to even your cash flow. So that's a great one. And same with salary finance in employer. It lends through employers. So Tesla is a salary finance customer. It offers salary finance to its employees because they get much lower cost loans, and it pays back out of their payroll every 2 weeks. And they love it because it's much cheaper than going out in the marketplace. So
I'm curious,
businesses like that.
Yeah, the Liberis and salary finance build on top of modular, or do they?
Yeah,
build
so in the UK, Liberis uses modular to open and power accounts as it funds businesses and make things easier and smoother for the merchant. So, you know, lots of companies, including our own, should be using modular. It just makes everything so much easier.
Do you see that a lot, where your portfolio companies collaborate with one another and you know, are customers of one another?
Yeah, so the collaboration happens at our CEOs. You know, they're often bumping into each other in scale space and sitting with each other and regularly doing learning sessions and sharing together and through their organizations. And then it also happens with where it makes sense. Like with Modular and Liberis, it just makes perfect sense for them to work together. So definitely where it makes sense, we do. But there's a huge amount of learning collaboration that goes on.
Do they ever compete with one another? I'm guessing they probably compete for resources from them.
Yeah, I don't really think we do. Would we be competing for the same tech resource? Maybe occasionally, not really. No, I don't think they do.
That's good. That would be a tough situation.
Yeah, then it would be tough.
You've talked a little bit about this. How do you as the management team go about deciding who works on which company? Is it for frontline workers? It's probably pretty obvious, but I'm thinking on the leadership team. Is it just that, hey, Miles understands prepaid debit and modular is going to be built on that, so it's pretty obvious that Miles should be running modular? Or is there
no, a so, formula? Some of the CEOs are the founders, some are placed in there and hired by Blenheim Chalcott. So from a CEO point of view, it depends on the business, whether they're co-founders or not. About half of them are co-founders and others are employed in place. And then Blenheim Chalcott has senior partners, Charles and Manoj, who founded the business. Also, Dan Cobley is amazing in the fintech marketing space. Dan was also the UK MD at Google. So he chaperones three or four of the companies. Mark Onya, another amazing partner of Blenheim Chalcott, great fintech expertise looks after another number of the companies. And then it passes down depending on what their needs are. So our investment teams might be busy with them at one point, our go-to-market teams, really based on the needs that CEO has. So very much a consultative process. And then what resources, how could they leverage BC? I think the thing we leverage most, John, you'll probably know this yourself in B2B, is our networks, our contacts. Are you the same with the way you do that?
Absolutely. From sales to partners to hiring, it's all about the network for sure.
Yeah. And you meet great people, you learn fast, you have good conversations, it stops you doing things you shouldn't. You get an intro to somebody you wouldn't have. Like that network, when most of our business is B2B, is really strong and useful. So I think that's the key part of collaboration across our businesses.
Very cool. You hinted at it a little bit, but how you talked about how during COVID you really sat down and said, how do we make lemonade out of these lemons? How did COVID affect the Blenheim as a whole overall? Was it a nasty shock? Was it an opportunity to reset, all of the above? How would you categorize how COVID affected your businesses?
We came out of it fantastically well, but we wouldn't have thought that in the first month of COVID. Everyone had that oh shit moment and what the hell are we going to do about this moment, as everyone worked out what's going to happen to demand, people, jobs. So I think what did happen is some of our companies got great wind at their back, like Hive Learning. Others didn't, like Liberis, that serves small businesses, all shut down. Mm-hmm. Had to really focus and manage to, you know, get through it, was the way I think about it. But what everyone did do was use the time to focus on their core. What's our core solution that we solve really well, better than others? Because that's all you could do. You had to be really focused to survive, grow, have your cash flow last, get new funding in. So everyone got ruthlessly better. I think you never see the best of people till their backs are against the wall. And then their minds really get to work in coming up with great solutions. And I was really proud to be part of that Blenheim Chalcott team and all the companies, because everybody was brilliant, literally brilliant in executing for all those businesses. And everybody came up with great ideas, made things happen that you would never believe would happen, where companies are coming out with more funding than they went in, more sales than they went in, a really clear focus on proposition.
That's awesome.
Necessity is a mother of all invention, right? And I think you see the best of people when they really have to perform.
I couldn't agree more. Whenever times are tough, we have a client that we've done something poorly, or we have an employee, or, you know, I say that this is when you build real partnerships. This is when you understand when a vendor screws something up and they make it right, they are a vendor for life, right?
Exactly.
It's
yeah.
A big opportunity.
Yeah. And we've all had those, and definitely during COVID year, where, you know, what are you going to do with these partnerships where nobody can deliver against them, and how are you going to manage that? And then actually, what's the opportunity to reset and improve it and do it better? And so those conversations turn into great opportunities. There's opportunity in every crisis, John, was the learning from COVID.
Yep. Now you have, I don't want to call it a pet project, but you have a framework, I believe, that you are a big fan of.
Yes. So I'm a fan of all the brilliant people who've come up with frameworks for startups and growing them. And there's the Steve Blanks of this world, and the Eric Ries and the Lean Startup, but there's a ton of these people. And you know, I have a theory that they should all be plotted together, and you'd have the perfect route map to create a startup, but at least you've got a guide with you all the way. So I write a blog. You can go to leearthur.com and find my blog.
And I'll link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, and I'm doing a 10-year startup map, because the other thing you should know if you're doing a startup, it's going to take a long time. So you should do something that you're going to love. And the point is, I'm going to continue to write about that and give good, real examples of the different phases of discovery, solution, and scaling, and what it takes, and who are the methods to follow, and how you follow them, and what you do, with some real examples. So I just think I would have loved that guide when I did my startup. It would have stopped me doing half the dumb things I did. And that's the other thing to remember as an entrepreneur. Someone else has done all these pain points and thought all these things through. So you should leverage and use that. I think that's going back to your initial question, what do entrepreneurs do? Like, people like me have got this, entrepreneurs have normally got this bias to action, or a lot of them, and you can be too action focused. So having a guide and doing the right actions, and I think that's what I'm writing it for. For me, you know, 15, 20 years ago, this is what you should have done, Lee, instead of doing it the way that I did it.
I like how you term it, the bias towards action. That yeah. is definitely me. And I can tell you, when we were building Level, that we, one of our investors was adamant about this book called Traction, and they yeah. have a framework for going in and defining core values and defining yeah. your niche and just going. And I don't care which exercise you do. There's yeah. a bunch of them that are out there, but going yeah. through that exercise is so crucial. But I remember when he told me about it, I was like, oh geez. So I start reading the book and I'm like, oh wow, this is actually very useful.
Exactly. Useful yeah. stuff. You're right. Any framework's better than none.
Yeah.
Someone else has done a lot of thinking on it, so you should at least use that. I massively agree. Yeah.
And what I've seen, there's a handful of these frameworks that I've now looked at, and there are definitely some commonalities between them, and very little that I've found where it's in direct conflict with one another. There just seems to yeah. be a lot of really good ideas that are shared between the frameworks, for sure.
Yeah, and I've got a great point on that. So, do you think, there's a lot of people who think of, you know, if you've got a great product, it sells itself. Another versus distribution is important. Do you think one's more important than the other? Product is more important than distribution, or vice versa?
That's a tough one. I tend to think that distribution is more important. And that's why you see when Salesforce.com buys a company that was selling the exact same product, they're now selling 10 times as much because they've got Salesforce's distribution. Same thing with IBM, right? I mean, yep. IBM has such distribution and so many tentacles into every organization that I don't know that the product really matters. I think we as founders get really wound up in the product, and it does matter to a certain extent, but I feel like these behemoths with these massive sales distribution channels prove that the product really isn't as important as we like to think.
Yeah, and I think that is massively the right answer. So the problem that I struggle most with is you see businesses scale and their product teams are trying to get the product perfect. And at no point is distribution designed or baked into the product. And the example I use with them is, would you like the best coffee shop in the world in a side street? You can have own this business, or you can own an okay coffee shop on the corner of the busiest street in the busiest city. The coffee ain't great, but you're going to get a lot of people. And everyone, time after time, chooses the second one because that's where you're going to make your money.
Yeah.
And so getting product people to think about distribution as they're creating, I think, is the game changer if I was an entrepreneur. Like, thinking about that, not just building the product, and then secondly thinking about go-to-market. That, for me, is like, you'll definitely have an improved chance of success.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you guys think when you think about distribution? Do you have a bias towards direct sales, or are you big on channel partnerships? I'm guessing it's different from business to business.
Yeah, so yeah, if I think about B2B, again, it's context is king, right? Who you're selling to. So corporate education, it's very much has been, it's changing a lot in terms of bottom up, but traditional top down approach. Corporate heads of HR and L&D sign off budgets in their org, and they've got a certain budget. So we're selling into them. In other businesses, we're thinking a lot more about bottom up and letting end users kind of find and discover and promote the product. So context specific, I think, to what the buying habits are and trends.
Absolutely. Well, look, Lee, I could talk for hours with you. I know you're a busy guy. I really appreciate you joining me today. I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I'm so glad to hear that 2020 turned out to be a great year for Blenheim. That's awesome.
No, thanks. I love the chat, and hopefully we get to do something together, John, isn't it?
Hopefully. And hopefully now that you've told me that the comedy clubs are opening back up in New York, I need to come up to New York and have a beer with you.
Yeah, exactly. Love that.
All right. Cheers, Lee. Thanks again.
Okay, mate. Yeah. All right. Welcome. Take care.